listening to the However Improbable podcast, a Sherlock Holmes book club that narrates and discusses Arthur Conan Doyle's classic tales. We're reading them in the order they occurred in the lives of the great detective and his good doctor.
Holmes himself famously said that there's nothing new under the sun, but we're willing to give him a run for his money. I'm Sarah Kolb.
And I'm Marissa Mercurio. This week, we're talking trepidatious translations, dire kidnappings, and Sherlock Holmes's extended family. Doyle ranked the story number 17 on his list of 19 favorite tales, and it's our first introduction to the infamous Mycroft Holmes. It's The Adventure of the Greek Interpreter.
The Adventure of the Greek Interpreter was published in The Strand and Harper's Weekly in the U.S. in 1893, both in the same year. It's featured in the short story collection The Memoirs of Sherlock Holmes, and Baring Gould places the story on September 12, 1888. To listen to our audio adaptation of the story, go back an episode. We will be here.
One evening, in the middle of a conversation about hereditary attributes, Holmes surprises Watson with the fact that he isn't the only person in the world possessing his unique blend of deductive reasoning. He's got an older brother, Mycroft, whose powers are greater than his own. Holmes and Watson set off to the Diogenes Club to meet Mycroft, who quickly proves the point by one-upping Holmes at his usually impressive deduct-a-stranger game. Mycroft introduces Holmes to a strange occurrence that he thinks the consulting detective may be able to help with, that of Mr. Melos, a Greek translator who was recently threatened by two sinister Brits.
Melos was hired by a man named Harold Latimer to act as an interpreter between himself, a Greek man named Critides, who was obviously being held hostage. Despite the threatening situation, Melos was able to cleverly sneak a few facts from Critides before a woman named Sophie burst into the room. Melos' sinister employers hustled him into a cab and threatened him if he should tell any of the story to anyone else.
Holmes agrees to help, but the villains are one step ahead of them and kidnap Melos. Along with Mycroft and Inspector Gregson, Holmes and Watson track him down. They arrive in time to save Melos, but not Critides, who has been killed with gas. Latimer and his accomplice Kemp have successfully fled to the continent, taking Sophie with them, who was Critides' sister. Though the siblings were in the same house, they didn't know of each other's presence until Sophie saw him refusing to sign away her fortune.
Sometime later, Holmes and Watson hear of Latimer and Kemp's murder by stabbing in Budapest. Hungarian police believe they killed one another, but Holmes surmises that Sophie has taken vengeance on behalf of herself and her brother.
Kind of a winding plot.
And then yeah, a lot happens in this story.
A very abrupt end.
How long has it been since you've read Adventure of the Greek Interpreter? I feel like this is a really iconic story.
This is an iconic story, but it's one that I have not read for a very long time. It's one of the Granada episodes, however, that I rewatch quite frequently. Mm-hmm. So it was in my head with all the action happening with the guy with the beard playing Melos and the little glasses and Jeremy Brett and David Burke. So it's very ingrained in my mind as an episode of Granada Holmes. So when I read the story itself for the first time in a long time, I was a little stunned by how different it was.
Mm, yeah.
What about you? What were your reactions to this story?
It's one that I always think about as being one of my favorites. And I really like it, but I never remember how dark it is.
It's incredibly dark. It's really dark.
Really, really creepy and sinister. And obviously, like, I don't know why that's not what sticks in my head. I think I just like the introduction of Mycroft so much, and that's what I remember. But the mystery itself is really very horrifying.
And also, there's very little actual mystery solving happening in the story. It's not really much of a deductive enterprise.
No, yeah, it's almost sort of like a...
It's very, a drama.
Yeah.
It's like a dark drama, more than anything.
Yeah, that's
like
true.
A thriller.
That's what it is. It's tense and
it's
weird.
It's an international thriller.
A little strangely paced, but I think it works out. I really like it. It was enjoyable to read, and I left it feeling considerably creeped out. So that's where I'm at with it, generally. I also really liked listening to it.
Yeah, I did too. It's fun to have some international flavor in these stories when it's not horribly offensive. Yeah. As it is, as it usually is when Conan Doyle's invoking countries that are not England.
Yeah, as far as I know...
Seemed fine to me.
The Greek stereotypes are not offensive. If you're Greek and you feel differently, I guess, let us know. But Mr. Melos is a good character, and Sophie's mm-hmm. a good character, so... And yes. The villains are all British.
So I think the obvious place we have to start with is Holmes's family.
I think this is why the story sticks out so much in my mind and why I love it so much. Up to this point, we have not gotten so many biographical details about who on earth his family is and where he comes from. And we find out, I mean, not a ton, but
not a ton.
A relative bounty of info compared to what we knew previously, which was basically nothing.
Well, and I think it's important to note, in terms of our chronology, that this being set in 1888 is now 7 years after Holmes and Watson have met each other, and Watson is only now finding anything out about Holmes's family life.
Yeah.
And yes. What Watson says about this is, quote, "This reticence upon his part had increased the somewhat inhuman effect which he produced upon me, until sometimes I found myself regarding him as an isolated phenomenon, a brain without a heart, as deficient in human sympathy as he was preeminent in intelligence." Which seems a little harsh after 7 years, I think, Watson.
Yeah, it's not a very kind description necessarily, but I think it tracks with some of the sort of ups and downs and tension and resolution we've seen their friendship go through mm-hmm. in recent stories, where the stars are out of Watson's eyes in this. He has a very honest opinion of who Holmes is.
He's taken a back seat on the hero worship. And I think it's also partially how Holmes projects himself, whether or not he actually is this inhuman machine, which he's not.
No. Spoiler alert.
But that's the way he projects himself.
Right.
And before we get into all Holmes's little nitty bits about his family and his weird family quirks.
Weird family.
I want to point out two little things. One, Watson mentions Holmes's aversion to women.
Mm-hmm.
I think the word aversion is interesting, can be taken in many different ways.
Yeah.
And it's not really extrapolated upon in this story. The other thing I wanted to mention that Watson mentions about Holmes is his, quote, "disclination to form new friendships."
I know.
Which I was like,
really funny.
Ugh, me too, Holmes.
I've got enough friends. I'm fine. Holmes has one friend and he's all set.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like these little details. An aversion, I think, is an interesting word because it's like avoidance.
Right. It's not dislike or hatred
or repulsion. He's just going to like go out of his way to not get involved in that if he can find something else.
Not interested.
Yeah. And this is all kind of right off the top in the first paragraph of this story, which Watson finishes by the hilarious assumption that he assumes that Holmes is an orphan because Holmes has never mentioned his family, and that's where Watson's mind goes.
Yeah, and Watson clearly has not pushed the situation.
No.
Finding anything out.
Yeah. So he finds a fair number of things. I mean, first and foremost, Holmes reveals pretty quickly that he has a brother. He is not mm-hmm. alone in this world, and it comes up because he's sort of, they're having this lighthearted debate about hereditary attributes and if things are taught or born.
Atavism, hereditary aptitudes, and what I think is essentially biological predestination, which all strikes me as very British, very Victorian, and very awful.
Right. With this, they're sitting around in their living room just chatting about this mm-hmm. topic.
This is a very, like, 1880s, 1890s conversation to be having, I think. Like, very post-Darwin, end of the century, fall of the empire conversation. Uh-huh. Like, ooh, are we biologically determined to act in certain ways? It's gross. It's not gross within the context of the story itself, but I think it's one of those conversations that you pull at the thread a little bit and it all unwinds into something very horrible.
Right. Sort of eugenics.
Yes, exactly.
And it's interesting the stances that they're sort of taking on this, because Watson is coming at it with like, well, Holmes, you, like, taught yourself your complicated logical process of deduction. And Holmes is going, well, you know, my family's also a little strange.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, is where he drops that surprise, he has an older brother.
Right.
And he provides a couple of other details about his extended family in general. What he says, first of all, he says that his ancestors were country squires. He says that his grandmother's sister was a French artist named Vernet. And then this is one of my favorite quotes. I think it's really fascinating, also a little disturbing when you start to peel back the layers, mm-hmm. where sort of describing the unusualness in his family line as having artists somewhere in his family. What he says is, quote, "Art in the blood is liable to take the strangest forms."
That is a really good line.
Yeah.
It also returns to this idea of deduction as art, which we've been talking about over the course of the entire podcast. Relatedly, Holmes later says that, quote, "If the art of the detective began and ended in reasoning from an armchair, my brother would be the greatest criminal agent that ever lived."
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's not. But I like that Holmes consistently frames deductive work and detection as an art.
Yeah.
Even though he also sometimes proffers it as this very strict, scientific, logical, rational, masculine method of reasoning, it also very much is an art, which we see all the way back from A Study in Scarlet.
Yeah, this has certainly been a theme that's come up a lot in a lot of different ways, sometimes in contrasting ways. He is not only saying that it is sort of an art form, but that it is coming from having artists in his blood.
Right.
So it's some sort of, like, higher calling as well as a skill set for him,
mm-hmm.
is a little bit what I'm getting from this.
I think it is interesting to think of deduction as a malleable form of art, that it mm-hmm. isn't just artistic, but that it literally is an art, and that it's not just an art in an ambiguous sense, but it is delineated from, like, painting.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's some relationship between painting and visual arts and deductive reasoning.
Like, he's not focused on the application, more on the abilities themselves,
mm-hmm.
which I think mm-hmm. is maybe a little different than how we've seen him talk about this before, where he's talked at great length at times about, you know, sort of stage managing the resolution of crimes so they feel satisfying or so they have artistic flair.
Yes.
And that's not this. I don't know. He's in kind of a fanciful mood in this story.
He is. I also really like what follows this, where Watson calls Holmes modest and Holmes laughs in Watson's face. He says, "My dear Watson, I cannot agree with those who rank modesty among the virtues. To the logician, all things should be seen exactly as they are, and to underestimate oneself is as much a departure from truth as to exaggerate one's own powers. When I say, therefore, that Mycroft has better powers of observation than I, you may take it that I am speaking the exact and literal truth." Which is very funny, but then also he does back it up with, "Here's why I think this."
Yeah, interesting sentiment about his unmentioned older mm-hmm. brother.
Yes. Is there anything else that we learn about Mycroft?
Well, Mycroft is 7 years, Holmes is senior, and then we get a sort of general sense that he works somewhere in logistics in the British government.
Yeah, he's an auditor.
Uh-huh.
Which is so funny to me. I had forgotten that we get Mycroft's actual, not just, oh, he's in the government,
yeah.
but that he, quote, "audits the books in some of the government departments." Which is so funny to me that we've gone from auditor to scary man in black, right, like, MI5 agent.
Super spy.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, just takes a look at the books. Yeah. Dude looks at the books, audits things.
Literally, he sits in an office and organizes things. I think we'll come back around to this trend to James mm-hmm. Bondify Mycroft Holmes, but
yes,
I do, like, I think we get a very specific and clear picture of Holmes's brother,
and he's just a dude. Yeah, he's literally just a dude who's weird.
He's weird,
definitely weird.
And then, of course, with that, Holmes, I really love this because it's been 7 years. There has been no indication that Holmes has any extended family. He drops the news like, "Oh, surprise, I have a living brother who lives, like, down the road. Do you want to go meet him?"
Right.
So Watson's, like, getting a lot of whiplash very quickly.
It's a lot happening in quick succession. The other thing I like is that Holmes introduces Watson to Mycroft at the Diogenes Club.
Yes.
And when he says, "I'm going to go, you know, take you to this weird place where no one talks," he says, "I shall be very happy to introduce you to two curiosities." My brother and the Diogenes Club.
Yeah, you ready for this line that I love? The Diogenes Club is the queerest club in London, and Mycroft, one of the queerest men.
Hell yeah, he is.
Yes, he is.
This really sounds like my kind of club.
Yeah.
Like, if I were to ever go clubbing, if you cannot tell listeners from the fact that I am a person who has never been to a club and does not, in fact, intend on going to one, this is exactly the kind of club I would attend. Yes. No one talks to me. Everyone's got newspapers or books in their faces.
Every now and then, just, a silent waiter brings you another beverage.
There's a distinct room where people are allowed to talk, or you get kicked out.
I think we're introduced to a very iconic character and to a very iconic location.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of in one fell swoop. And they're very connected in my mind. Mycroft mm-hmm. and the strangest gentleman's club in London. The Diogenes Club, where he hangs out. And so it is like a two-for-one. Like, here's Mycroft and here's this strange place that pops up in so many pastiche and I think is very iconic to the slightly unusual world of Sherlock Holmes. I really love it.
I love that, too, and I love thinking about the Holmes brothers with their specific locations.
Yeah.
Their specific iconic locations that are manifestations of their personalities.
Mm-hmm. That's very great. Much so. Obviously, we spend a lot of time inside of Holmes's home because it's mm-hmm. also his place of work. But then we get some details about Mycroft, who he lives across the street from.
Mm-hmm.
So he wakes up, he goes to an office, he goes to the club, which is across the street from his house, and he goes mm-hmm. home. And he does every day. So he has this very specific movement through London and mm-hmm. three places where he is versus Holmes, who has this central locus and then obviously is reaching his investigative fingers into all of these different parts of the city, high and low and everywhere in between. So I like that contrast between the two brothers. We get these details before we even meet Mycroft himself. It's really good.
It is. It's very excellent. The other thing that we learn about Mycroft is that, according to Holmes, he has, quote, no ambition and no energy, and will not even verify his deductions and prefers to be seen as wrong than put the energy into proving himself right.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, to get back to this idea of Mycroft's character and the way that has been and shifted in adaptations, is how do we get from this guy who has no ambition and no energy and can't even bother to prove himself right when he is right to this insidious man behind the curtains of
mm-hmm.
these modern adaptations? It's so interesting.
Yeah. Mycroft is a theoretical deducer,
mm-hmm.
and Holmes is a practical one. I think that's the difference between them, where their skill set is the same, back to this broader conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Mycroft is perhaps more developed, but he doesn't try at it. It's just, almost his party trick. They do this party trick bit for Watson.
Yes, it's a party trick. That's perfect.
They show up, they're let into the room that's quiet, and then both brothers sort of compete to deduce this guy on the street. And they're mm-hmm. they're showing off for Watson. They're not doing it for each other.
Absolutely. They are showing off. And I think even in the Soviet adaptation, Holmes and Mycroft say something about, oh, we were trying to impress Dr. Watson. And at this moment in the Diogenes Club, when they are doing that deductive tennis match in front of Watson, I love Watson's reaction to it. He says, come, I said, laughing. This is a little too much.
When it's he's lived with Holmes for ever at this point, he's seen a lot, mm-hmm. and this is he's like, okay, guys, I get it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the bit where Holmes goes, and he's got a child, and Mycroft is like, children, my dear boy, children.
Children.
Come on, how could you have missed this? So here's a little description about Mycroft that is, again, differentiating the two brothers that I like. This is Watson describing him. So he says, his eyes, which were of a peculiarly light, watery gray, seemed to always retain that faraway, introspective look which I had only observed in Sherlock's when he was exerting his full powers. So something that sort of comes to light in Holmes at certain times, Mycroft always has, which is interesting.
Right. The other thing that we learn about Mycroft's physical appearance is that he's quite heavy.
Yeah.
In, again, comparison to Holmes, who is a rail.
Razor thin.
Right, he's a stick.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Which I like. Mm-hmm. I'm on Mycroft's side. I would love to sit in an armchair and eat bread.
And just, people watch.
Yeah. That's what he does. Yeah, he goes to work and then he people watches and reads books. Sounds pretty nice to me.
It does.
I think Mycroft Holmes has things figured out, in my opinion.
So, this is the moment when Mr. Mylas is introduced, tells us the whole story of what he has experienced, and I would like to shift maybe a little bit into the plot of The Greek Interpreter, talk about how tonally dark and sinister it is, and just what is going on here with the characters.
One weird, interesting detail is that Mylas and Mycroft live in the same building. That's how they know each other. I like that for some reason. Yeah, no, this mystery, I think, is really the darkest story we've encountered in a while. Probably since, like, the Speckled Band, which was way back at the beginning of this podcast.
Yes, and I think it's worth noting that in addition to all the violence that happens in the story, which I definitely want to talk about, it's sinister because it's centered around this question of female inheritance.
Yeah.
In the same way that Speckled Band was.
Yeah, that's true.
The lack of women having ownership of their own property and rights and fortune.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's these two men trying to manipulate a woman's brother into giving her money away.
Mm-hmm.
They have, physical control of her.
The most that we know is that Sophie was in London by herself, and that she became attached and perhaps even engaged or about to be engaged to one of the men. And then Sophie's friends contacted Paul, her brother. His first name is Paul. And was like, hey, Sophie's in this weird situation. We don't think it's great. Girls looking out for girls.
Yeah.
And then Paul comes to London, speaks no English, and so has a lot of trouble navigating the city. And then the two men, aware of Paul's attempts to help his sister, kidnap Paul and begin to abuse him, physically abuse him, starve him, and attempt to, as we have said, get him to sign over Sophie's fortune
from them, essentially. Yeah, I think he's a really interesting character. I think a really brave, selfless guy, and his story is very tragic and it sucks. He tries to do a very big scary thing, going to a large metropolitan city where you don't speak the language to help his sister. It's very admirable and
absolutely.
It does not go well for him, so I feel bad.
I do too. I also really like the story about siblings.
Yeah.
And particularly a brother and a sister, which I don't think you see a lot of in media. Even now, I always really enjoy seeing stories that are about a brother and a sister and their devotion to one another. And what's interesting about this, too, is that Paul and Sophie don't know that the other is in the same building. And so that idea of, thinking of that moment when Sophie bursts into the room when she sees Paul is so dramatic. And it's just, it's a really strong moment, even though it's told in secondhand.
Yeah. No, it's very visual. You see, you feel the emotions of the people involved very clearly, which I really like.
Right. And I think it makes for a good adaptation, too. Mm-hmm. This is why the Granada episode is so good, because it allows you to see all those moments. It allows you to see the emotions and the relationship between all the characters.
And they also, something worth noting, which I think this is just has always creeped me out. It's creepy in the Granada adaptation, is that these two kidnappers wrap his face up in bandages he can't talk. So people don't recognize him. So theoretically, if Sophie sees him, she's going to be starving, wrapped up man is definitely not my brother.
Right.
There's so many
creepy little aspects about this story. I mean, just the idea of the laughing man constantly having this little vibe going on is very disconcerting.
Yes. Yeah, I have this paragraph. I don't really read the whole thing, but it's Mylas sort of describing him. Mm-hmm. And he says that he could not help thinking his strange, catchy little laugh was also a symptom of some nervous malady. And the terror of his face lay in his eyes, however, steel gray and glistening coldly with a malignant, inexorable cruelty in their depths. Very dramatic.
Ooh, very good. I also want to talk about how literally, explicitly violent the story is, because the moment when the whole crew winds up at the house where Paul and Sophie were being kept, too late to find Paul dead and Melas barely hanging on, right, is so horrible. And I would like to read this passage
Please terrify us.
Grotesque it is. So this is right when they come upon them. Both of them were blue-lipped and insensible, with swollen, congested faces and protruding eyes. Indeed, so distorted were their features that, save for his black beard and stout figure, we might have failed to recognize in one of them the Greek interpreter who had parted from us only a few hours before at the Diogenes Club. His hands and feet were securely strapped together, and he bore over one eye the marks of a violent blow. The other, who was secured in a similar fashion, was a tall man in the last stage of emaciation, with several strips of sticking plaster arranged in a grotesque pattern over his face. He had ceased to moan as we laid him down, and a glance showed me that for him at least our aid had come too late.
It's very vivid and terrifying.
It's dark. It's really dark.
Yeah.
And on the page, dark. A lot of times we hear about things secondhand, but don't get the descriptions of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Watson really lays everything out for you here.
In this, I also think that, like, last stages of emaciation, like, this has been going on for a while.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Too. It hasn't just been a couple days. It's been, like, Paul has been suffering for a substantial period of time.
And on top of all this, they get away.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a time gap between three of them, the two men and Sophie, escaping to the continent and hearing about the stabbing in Budapest.
Right, yeah, and it's hard to say what happened to Sophie in that time period. Yeah.
So it's, I mean, it's dark. And it's another instance of a mystery where there's not really any problem solving or success either.
Yeah, I was going to say Holmes does very little. It's been a little bit of a theme where he arguably, they could have gone to anybody else or to the police for help and things would have happened exactly the same way. He doesn't really even do any deducing. He just listens to the story and he's like, yeah, that's a little strange. And then they go home and Mycroft is like, oh, we got to get going because Melas has gone missing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they show up here. Like, Mycroft could have gone to the cops, and that would have...
It would have been the same. Watson even does a good job surmising what has happened. Mm-hmm. He guesses exactly the relationship between the men and Sophie, and the fact that they are trying to take Sophie's money. And Holmes says to him, excellent, Watson, I really fancy you are not far from the truth. Like, good job, Watson.
Adds it all up for us. Thanks, Watson. Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, the real hero of the story is Mr. Melas.
Mm-hmm.
Who,
for doing anything.
Yeah.
Right? And, oh my god, do you want to talk about that excellent passage where he's telling the story to Watson and he puts in his own questions when he's talking to Paul?
I love this. I think this is really, it's like so clever. And I think it's one of the things that really delights me about the story is it's almost a story about someone else's cleverness that Holmes just sort of happens to overhear. Because Melas figures out pretty quickly that Critates doesn't speak any English and they don't speak Greek. And so he starts doing this like really sneaky espionage translating where he adds just a couple words enough so like they're not catching on that he's talking a lot more than what they're saying. But he's able to figure out his name, kind of what happened, the general backstory, thinking he's going to be able to help. It's really cool. It's just like
under
so
the threat
clever.
Of death.
Right,
also.
Yeah, with these, like, really terrifying men who stuff him in a cab, drive him for 2 hours, take him to a weird house, and are like, if you say anything about what's about to happen, we'll kill you.
Yeah, it's really about this guy, isn't it?
Yeah.
About the Greek interpreter.
Yeah, hence the name of the story.
Yes.
It is the Greek interpreter's adventure.
It's very much, yes, about Sophie.
Yeah.
To me as well, as little as we see her on the page, because obviously, we get this fantastic ending with her. The other thing that we get with her that I think was a great little insight into her intelligence is that Conan Doyle writes that, quote, her feminine perceptions, however, had instantly seen through the disguise when, on the occasion of the interpreter's first visit, she had seen him for the first time. So we get the sense of Sophie knowing that something's wrong and there's some suspicion here about what the interpreter's involvement is. And then that all comes to a head when several days, weeks, months later, who knows, at some indeterminate point, that Holmes and Watson learn about the stabbing in Budapest.
I mean, I very much read this as, like, she waits until these men have let their guard down and then she kills them.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's really awesome. It's very vigilante justice, which she does with, like, no involvement from anybody else. And, I mean, I hope that she gets away and can sort of find some happiness after this happens. I think she's a really fascinating character, but the ending is very abrupt. Like, it's very, very action-packed right up to the end, and then it just sort of stops, and there's this paragraph of, like, a big block of text that's summarizing this. So the pacing's a little strange, where I think I wish there were a few more details.
Oh, well, when I was reading it, I was like, all right, we're about to get to the train. And then I was...
Granada.
Oh, no.
Yeah, Granada. There's no train. Really, they really embellish the end of the story in a way that I don't love as much as I think I want to. No, I think there's a lot of... If you were doing a really good adaptation, there's a lot of stuff you could do to let this happen visually and to provide some more context. Because I can really, like, in my mind, I'm really imagining, you know, she's, like, letting time go by and waiting for the right opportunity and probably enduring something quite horrible. And then it strikes and she's able to get her revenge and probably has a great killer line about, you killed my brother and now I'm going to kill you. And
yes.
Yeah, who knows? Well, I'm just romanticizing her. But
you know, I think she's awesome. She's so cool. What Watson says about this at the end of the story is, quote, Holmes, however, is, I fancy, of a different way of thinking. And he holds to this day that if one could find the Grecian girl, one might learn how the wrongs of herself and her brother came to be avenged.
Mm.
Very good. Love a story about revenge. Also really like that it's not only herself, but her brother.
Yeah.
That she is enacting revenge upon.
Mm-hmm.
Or avenging.
Yeah.
So
in other Holmes stories, we've seen instances of men sort of feeling they have to take women's vengeance for them.
Mm.
And that certainly does not happen here. She gets her vengeance and her brother's vengeance.
So that's a nice great point.
Reversal. Happy International Women's Day.
Happy International Women's Day. We are recording on. Go stab some men in Budapest. Yeah. Just go do it.
Stab some men in Budapest.
Well, I think that's a great point about the reversal. It makes me think of A Case of Identity in which Holmes very deliberately does not tell, what was her name, Mary, I think, about the horrible situation that she was in. And there's information being kept from women and doesn't allow them to act on that information. Whereas in this story, it is very much Sophie taking the situation into her own hands.
Yeah.
Very Kitty Winter of her.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a... It's nice to see this sort of earlier because it's going to be a while until we get to meet Kitty Winter.
Mm-hmm.
That's a later case, but it's the start of this thread, which we're going to see in a number of upcoming cases. Milverton is another one that feels similar to this in a lot of ways, which again is a while away, but is so good.
Yes. So good. Well, what I would like to do, because we are already sort of talking about it, is to get into the adaptations. Because
sure.
I have some thoughts about the Granada episode in particular. I
know. Same. Yeah, there's a couple that I want to mention. There are so many, I think, tangential adaptations of this story because everyone wants to put Mycroft in their pastiches and stuff. That's not what we're going to talk about right now. I picked out a couple that I think are as close as we're getting to direct adaptations of the Greek interpreter, and they're not as many as I thought, which is a little bit of a bummer. None of the, like, really major recent adaptations have done this directly. The closest that we get is an episode in season 2 of Elementary called Art in the Blood, which of course comes from a line from this story, which is about their version of Mycroft and his sort of, like, spy espionage past.
Yeah, like a kidnapping reveal.
Yeah.
Involved in it.
So there's a little bit of those threads, but it's not, you know, like, about Greek siblings getting justice or anything. So,
no, not at all.
So I've picked out two that I just want to note it. One, which is not a direct adaptation, and one that is. The first being Russian Holmes, third episode. mm-hmm. or long film, however you want to define them, right. Which this one's interesting because the plot of this is based on the adventure of Charles Augustus Milverton, the master blackmailer case, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they take probably the first half of this story and Mycroft's introduction and the little deducing game and Mycroft handing this complicated case to Holmes right out of Greek Interpreter and then stick it onto the plot of Milverton, which I think works very well. It's a really good story, but again, makes me kind of bummed out that they didn't do the Greek Interpreter.
Yeah.
Because they do a good job and they're really good with their sinister villains. However, it is a good episode and I recommend watching it. And then the second, of course, being Granada. In this one, it's very interesting to me because it's largely book accurate. Most of the time they are, but they change the ending. And you were alluding to this earlier when you're talking about the train situation, because the villains don't get away in the Granada adaptation. Everything else is almost exact, except for this.
Yeah, so the villains do abscond to the degree to which they get on the train.
Right. They're trying to get out of the country.
So, exactly. So Holmes and Watson and the crew, they arrive at the house. They find that Paul has died and that Melas is alive. And Watson does his little doctoring. And then they follow these guys onto the train with Sophie. And Mycroft comes with them. Because why not? Just got to put Mycroft in there some more. And I personally love anything set on a train. So I am delighted to do some mystery solving on a train. And it is very... One moment that always sticks out in my mind is that shot of Jeremy Brett smoking his cigarette next to the no smoking sign in the compartment.
Yeah.
And Mycroft does his own little mystery solving. He talks to the laughing man and pretends to be somebody else. The thing that I don't like about this is how it affects Sophie's character.
Because she gets rescued.
She gets rescued. Okay, so, like, the men are on the train, and Holmes finds her, and it starts to get quite violent. People are pulling out their guns, so on and so forth. The sense of it being is that Sophie is still in love with this man that she was going to marry, and that she sort of threw over her brother for this man. Or at least, if not having any active participatory role in her brother's death, was still willing to marry this man despite the fact that he killed her brother. Holmes makes some disparaging comments about her, which would be fair if that's actually what happened, but of course this is a very intentional change from the story. And Sophie gets arrested, right?
I think so, yeah.
Or at least she gets taken away, and there's no stabbing.
Yeah, she doesn't get
to do anything. She doesn't get to take revenge on these men at all.
Yeah. Yeah, she's very passive in that. She's, like, vaguely villainous, but very passive in a way that clearly she isn't. Even though the ending happens off screen, it's very satisfying.
This episode picks up on that line about Holmes's aversion to women, which we referenced earlier, only it just extrapolates it to a degree that I think is out of character.
Yeah.
Because Holmes, he's kind of right in this sense. If we just take it in a vacuum, what Sophie does in the episode of Granada, Holmes, is kind of horrid. And that he's right in the individual sense about this woman. And then it therefore sort of proves his point about women more broadly.
Whereas,
this story, I think that Sophie is a much more interesting character despite the fact that we don't see her very often. And coupled with the fact that in basically every Conan Doyle short story in which Holmes has some disparaging comments about women, he's being proven wrong by the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the Granada episode, it sort of supports Holmes's feelings about women.
Yeah. Yeah, it sets him up to be right. When in the story he fails quite epically and, like, she gets the last word, so to speak. And I think this is a little bit of a trap that adaptations of Holmes fall into in general, is they always want him to be the person to solve the mystery. Even when that's not happening in the stories that they're based on, it just doesn't happen all the time. Sometimes he gets it wrong. Sometimes he has next to nothing to do with what's going on, and it's just a good story that Watson decided to write down. which is very much in this case. So that's what it is, I think. But that's not what you expect in a Holmes adaptation. So they had to make some changes to make him more active in the resolution, which is then taking agency away from her.
That sums up my thoughts about the episode. I really do like the Granada episode, except for the end.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So it is a bummer.
It's very like tense and well put together up until that point. That is a really great, interesting action sequence. It just misses the point of the story a little bit.
Yeah, I agree.
A little bit.
It should really be more about sibling devotion.
Yeah. And anything. If they were going to write an ending, they could have had something where she gets her justice on screen and Holmes chooses to let her go or let it pass.
Right. Just let her stab the men on the train. Like, if we don't want to spend all this time going to Hungary, just, you know, let her stab some guys on the train, let Holmes let her go, which he does.
Would have been in character.
In other stories.
Exactly.
He lets people go. They deserved it. So, mm-hmm. You know. So in lieu of read-alikes this week, we are going to offer a couple of recommendations of pastiches that feature Mycroft Holmes. So the first one being Mycroft Holmes by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Anna Waterhouse.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the basketball player, yeah.
Lindsay Fay mentioned this in our conversation.
Oh, nice.
Which you will be hearing soon. So double recommendation. The next one is The Italian Secretary by Caleb Carr, also the author of The Alienist. Mm-hmm. Quinn Fawcett wrote a series of mystery novels focusing on Mycroft, beginning with Against the Brotherhood, a Mycroft Holmes novel. And Mycroft is featured as a major character in the Enola Holmes children book series.
And he's sort of I don't think he's a villain, but he's the antagonist a little bit to Enola. Because
he's always antagonistic. I mean, not always, but very often. Maybe we should talk here a little bit about our case file coming
up. Yes. You notice that we haven't really talked about depictions of Mycroft on TV. And lots of people have played Mycroft over the years. And that's because we're saving that for a special little case file, really digging into him. Because I think there's some really interesting stuff in really interesting directions his character has gone in 50 or 60 years of Holmes adaptations that don't really have anything to do with who we meet in this story. So next week, we're going to do a little mini case file looking at some major adaptations and some of the iconic actors who have played him and try to get to the bottom of why he's always a super spy.
Right. Because there really is so much to say about this character who features in so few stories.
Yeah.
But he's like Moriarty in the way that he has just skyrocketed in terms of the ratio between, you know, stories he's in and adaptations he's in. Mm-hmm. Because if you're doing a Sherlock Holmes adaptation, you're probably going to include Mycroft Holmes because he's the only family member of Holmes' family that we know about canonically. And he's just kind of like a cool, weird dude that's fun to think about. So we will be doing a little mini case file episode on him and particularly the way that he's featured in adaptations.
Yes. Yeah, I'm excited to have this conversation, and I think it's going to be really interesting. Before we wrap this episode up, I did want to mention something. I think Mycroft looms so large that he's sort of invented his own fiction trope.
Oh, what's that?
Of people making fun of him a little bit, which is famous detectives with secret brothers. Which I didn't really think that this was a thing, but there's a little bit of a trend here. So here's a couple examples. So the TV show Monk, mm-hmm. which is a sort of procedural cop drama about a sort of ex-detective with OCD who solves crimes. Adrian Monk has an older brother called Ambrose Monk. Ambrose has uncanny powers of deduction. Unfortunately, he also has agoraphobia and he never leaves his house. So that's very clearly a Mycroft reference. Agatha Christie's novel, The Big Four, introduces a character called Achille Poirot, the supposed twin brother of Hercule Poirot.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, her famous detective, who's definitely based on Mycroft. Christie notoriously was not a Holmes fan, so this is mocking, for sure. Like Mycroft, he's depicted as being just as brilliant as his brother, but too indolent to accomplish very much. And then at the end, it's revealed that he's just Poirot himself dressed up in disguise.
Oh, man.
So that's very on the nose. And then this is my favorite detail here. So at one point, it was planned in the medical drama House, which is a loose adaptation, I would say, of the Holmes stories, that Gregory House was going to have an elder brother based on Mycroft, who was going to be played by Stephen Fry. Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie, of course, are, like, longtime comedic partners and really good friends.
A bit of Fry and Laurie.
Yes, but it didn't work out in the House TV show. They couldn't make it work. But then Stephen Fry goes on to play Mycroft in Guy Ritchie's Holmes, so.
And is one of the best, I think.
Yeah, that spoiler alert for our case file, he's definitely my favorite.
Really excited to talk about this. What a bummer. I've never watched House, but I really into this. Yes. I know.
Yeah, so if you can think of any other famous detectives with secret brothers,
let us know.
At least three of them.
Yeah.
Or four if you're counting Holmes himself.
Right.
I think that's it. I love Mycroft.
I enjoy Mycroft very much. I think justice for Mycroft.
Yeah.
Like, is going to be our refrain next week.
Better justice. He's just this, like, weird man who just wants to spend his time doing his very specific little hobbies.
Justice for weird men who like to sit around, do nothing, eat, chill.
And occasionally drop by and visit their weird but energetic younger brothers who are busy becoming famous for some reason. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is the detail that I want to end on. I forgot to mention this earlier. I think that Mycroft is a reader of Watson's stories.
Great point. Yes, we didn't talk about this.
Because when he meets Watson for the first time, he makes some comment like, I have been hearing of Sherlock everywhere since you started chronicling him. And I really love that.
I really like the idea of Mycroft getting a copy of The Strand and being like, ho, 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 let's Sherlock up
I'm
going to
make fun of him later.
Yes.
I also think, they communicate, like, they don't drop by each other's houses very much. But
no,
they bet they write
not.
Letters on occasion.
Yeah, and probably in some, like, weird coded language,
too. Oh, I'm
too.
Sure. They're, like, secret childhood.
That they've had, yes, exactly, since childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Precisely.
And so he probably just, like, cuts out these articles and mails them to Holmes without any comment. Just like, hey, I've seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
or like,
you
should have known
you? The
solution to this on page 4.
Very clearly, it was this, and you got it wrong.
Oh, brothers.
I know. Their deductive tennis match. So real. As we've said, please join us next week for a mini case file about Mycroft Holmes. We want to know who your favorite Mycroft is. What do you think of Holmes's brother? Is he a devoted sibling or insidious government agent or something in between? We'll dive into it.
And we have one more coming, another case file. Stay tuned for our conversation with pastiche author and all-around Sherlockian extraordinaire Lindsay Fay.
So excited about this.
So excited. And a special thanks to our narrator, Yanni Papademos.
You can send your thoughts on the story or this episode to howeverimprobablepod@gmail.com or reach us on Twitter @improbablepod. Our website, howeverimprobablepodcast.com, has got transcripts, the research behind the episode, and suggestions for further reading. If you enjoyed the show and can spare a moment, please rate and review.
However Improbable is created by Marissa Mercurio and Sarah Kolb, with apologies to Arthur Conan Doyle. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, dear listeners, believe us to be very sincerely yours.